European societies of the 19th century. As PDF Figure 10.7 shows, the rate of return on capital was significantly higher than the growth rate in France from 1820 to 1913, around 5% on average, compared with a growth rate of around 1%. Income from capital accounted for nearly 40% of national income, and it was enough to save one quarter of this to generate a savings rate on the order of 10%. See PDF Figure 10.8. This was sufficient to allow wealth to grow slightly more rapidly than income, so that the concentration of wealth trended upward. In the next chapter, I will show that most wealth in this period did come from inheritance, and this supremacy of inherited capital, despite the period's great economic dynamism and impressive financial sophistication, is explained by the dynamic effects of the fundamental inequality. R is greater than G. The very rich French probate data allow us to be quite precise about this point. Why is the return on capital greater than the growth rate? Let me pursue the logic of the argument. Are there deep reasons why the return on capital should be systematically higher than the rate of growth? To be clear, I take this to be a historical fact, not a logical necessity. It is an incontrovertible historical reality that R was indeed greater than G over a long period of time. Many people, when first confronted with this claim, express astonishment and wonder why it should be true. The most obvious way to convince oneself that R is greater than G is indeed a historical fact is no doubt the following. As I showed in Part 1, economic growth was virtually nil throughout much of human history. Combining demographic with economic growth, we can say that the annual growth rate from antiquity to the 17th century never exceeded 0.1 to 0.2% for long. Despite the many historical uncertainties, there is no doubt that the rate of return on capital was always considerably greater than this. The central value observed over the long run is 4 to 5% a year. In particular, this was the return on land in most traditional agrarian societies. Even if we accept a much lower estimate of the pure yield on capital, for example, by accepting the argument that many landowners have made over the years that it is no simple matter to manage a large estate, so that this return actually reflects a just compensation for the highly skilled labor contributed by the owner, we would still be left with a minimum, and to my mind unrealistic and much too low, return on capital of at least 2 to 3% a year, which is still much greater than 0.1 to 0.2%. Thus, throughout most of human history, the inescapable fact is that the rate of return on capital was always at least 10 to 20 times greater than the rate of growth of output and income. Indeed, this fact is to a large extent the very foundation of society itself. It is what allowed a class of owners to devote themselves to something other than their own subsistence. In order to illustrate this point as clearly as possible, I have shown in PDF Figure 10.9 the evolution of the global rate of return on capital and the growth rate from antiquity to the 21st century. These are obviously approximate and uncertain estimates, but the orders of magnitude and overall evolutions may be taken as valid. For the global growth rate, I have used the historical estimates and projections discussed in Part 1. For the global rate of return on capital, I have used the estimates for Britain and France in the period 1700 to 2010, which were analyzed in Part 2. For early periods, I have used a pure return of 4.5%, which should be taken as a minimum value. Available historical data suggest average returns on the order of 5 to 6%. For the 21st century, I have assumed that the value observed in the period 1990 to 2010, about 4%, will continue. But this is, of course, uncertain. There are forces pushing toward a lower return and other forces pushing toward a higher. Note, too, that the returns on capital in PDF Figure 10.8 are pre-tax returns, and also do not take account of capital losses due to war or of capital gains and losses which were especially large in the 20th century. As PDF Figure 10.9 shows, the pure rate of return on capital, generally 4-5%, has throughout history always been distinctly greater than the global growth rate. But the gap between the two shrank significantly during the 20th century, especially in the second half of the century, when the global economy grew at a rate of 3.5-4% a year. In all likelihood, the gap will widen again in the 21st century as growth, especially demographic growth, slows. According to the central scenario discussed in Part 1, global growth is likely to be around 1.5% a year between 2050 and 2100, roughly the same rate as in the 19th century. The gap between R and G would then return to a level comparable to that which existed during the Industrial Revolution. In such a context, it is easy to see that taxes on capital, and shocks of various kinds, can play a central role. Before World War I, taxes on capital were very low. Most countries did not tax either personal income or corporate profits, and estate taxes were generally no more than a few percent. To simplify matters, we may therefore assume that the rate of return on capital was virtually the same after taxes as before. After World War I, the tax rates on top incomes, profits, and wealth quickly rose to high levels. Since the 1980s, however, as the ideological climate changed dramatically under the influence of financial globalization and heightened competition between states for capital, these same tax rates have been falling, and in some cases have almost entirely disappeared. PDF Figure 10.10 shows my estimates of the average return on capital after taxes and after accounting for estimated capital losses due to destruction of property in the period 1913 to 1950. For the sake of argument, I have also assumed that fiscal competition will gradually lead to total disappearance of taxes on capital in the 21st century. The average tax rate on capital is set at 30% for 1913 to 2012, 10% for 2012 to 2050, and 0% in 2050 to 2100. Of course, things are more complicated in practice. Taxes vary enormously, depending on the country and type of property. At times, they are progressive, meaning that the tax rate increases with the level of income or wealth, at least in theory. And obviously, it is not foreordained that fiscal competition must proceed to its ultimate conclusion. Under these assumptions, we find that the return on capital, net of taxes and losses, fell to 1-1.5% in the period 1913 to 1950, which was less than the rate of growth. This novel situation continued in the period 1950 to 2012, owing to the exceptionally high growth rate. Ultimately, we find that in the 20th century, both fiscal and non-fiscal shocks created a situation in which, for the first time in history, the net return on capital was less than the growth rate. A concatenation of circumstances, wartime destruction, progressive tax policies made possible by the shocks of 1914 to 1945, and exceptional growth during the three decades following the end of World War II, thus created a historically unprecedented situation, which lasted for nearly a century. All signs are, however, that it is about to end. If fiscal competition proceeds to its logical conclusion, which it may, the gap between R and G will return at some point in the 21st century to a level close to what it was in the 19th century. See PDF Figure 10.10. If the average tax rate on capital stays at around 30%, which is by no means certain, the net rate of return on capital will most likely rise to a level significantly above the growth rate, at least if the central scenario turns out to be correct. To bring this possible evolution out even more clearly, I have combined in PDF Figure 10.11 the two sub-periods 1913 to 1950 and 1950 to 2012 into a single average for the century, 1913 to 2012. The unprecedented era during which the net rate of return on capital was less than the growth rate. I have also combined the two sub-periods, 2012 to 2050 and 2050 to 2100, into a single average for 2012 to 2100, and assumed that the rates for the second half of the 21st century would continue into the 22nd century, which is, of course, by no means guaranteed. In any case, PDF Figure 10.11 at least brings out the unprecedented, and possibly unique, character of the 20th century in regard to the relation between R and G. Note, too, that the hypothesis that global growth will continue at a rate of 1.5% a year over the very long run is regarded as excessively optimistic by many observers. Recall that the average growth of global per capita output was 0.8% a year between 1700 and 2012, and demographic growth, which also averaged 0.8% a year over the past three centuries, is expected to drop sharply between now and the end of the 21st century, according to most forecasts. Note, however, that the principal shortcoming of PDF Figure 10.11 is that it relies on the assumption that no significant political reaction will alter the course of capitalism and financial globalization over the course of the next two centuries. Given the tumultuous history of the past century, this is a dubious and, to my mind, not very plausible hypothesis, precisely because its inegalitarian consequences would be considerable and would probably not be tolerated indefinitely. To sum up, the inequality R is greater than G has clearly been true throughout most of human history, right up to the eve of World War I. And it will probably be true again in the 21st century. Its truth depends, however, on the shocks to which capital is subject, as well as on what public policies and institutions are put in place to regulate the relationship between capital and labor. The question of time preference. To recap, the inequality R is greater than G is a contingent historical proposition, which is true in some periods and political contexts, and not in others. From a strictly logical point of view, it is perfectly possible to imagine a society in which the growth rate is greater than the return on capital, even in the absence of state intervention. Everything depends, on the one hand, on technology. What is capital used for? And, on the other, on attitudes toward saving and property. Why do people choose to hold capital? As noted, it is perfectly possible to imagine a society in which capital has no uses other than to serve as a pure store of value, with a return strictly equal to zero, but in which people would choose to hold a lot of it in anticipation, say, of some future catastrophe or grand potlatch, or simply because they are particularly patient and take a generous attitude toward future generations. If, moreover, productivity growth in this society is rapid, either because of constant innovation or because the country is rapidly catching up with more technologically advanced countries, then the growth rate may very well be distinctly higher than the rate of return on capital. In practice, however, there appears never to have been a society in which the rate of return on capital fell naturally and persistently to less than 2 to 3%, and the mean return we generally see, averaging over all types of investments, is generally closer to 4 to 5% before taxes. In particular, the return on agricultural land in traditional societies, like the return on real estate in today's societies, these being the most common and least risky forms of investment in each case, is generally around 4 to 5%, with perhaps a slight downward trend over the very long run, to 3 to 4%, rather than 4 to 5. The economic model generally used to explain this relative stability of the return on capital at around 4 to 5%, as well as the fact that it never falls below 2 to 3%, is based on the notion of time preference in favor of the present. In other words, economic actors are characterized by a rate of time preference, usually denoted zero, that measures how impatient they are and how they take the future into account. For example, if 0 equals 5%, the actor in question is prepared to sacrifice 105 euros of consumption tomorrow in order to consume an additional 100 euros today. This theory, like many theoretical models in economics, is somewhat tautological. One can always explain any observed behavior by assuming that the actors involved have preferences, or utility functions, in the jargon of the profession, that lead them to act that way. And its predictive power is radical and implacable. In the case in point, assuming a zero-growth economy, it is not surprising to discover that the rate of return on capital must equal the time preference zero. According to this theory, the reason why the return on capital has been historically stable at 4-5% is ultimately psychological. Since this rate of return reflects the average person's impatience and attitude toward the future, it cannot vary much from this level. In addition to being tautological, the theory raises a number of other difficulties. To be sure, the intuition that lies behind the model, like that which lies behind marginal productivity theory, cannot be entirely wrong. All other things equal, a more patient society, or one that anticipates future shocks, will of course amass greater reserves and accumulate more capital. Similarly, if a society accumulates so much capital that the return on capital is persistently low, say 1% a year, or in which all forms of wealth, including the property of the middle and lower classes, are taxed so that the net return is very low, then a significant proportion of property-owning individuals will seek to sell their homes and financial assets, thus decreasing the capital stock until the yield rises. The problem with the theory is that it is too simplistic and systematic. It is impossible to encapsulate all savings behavior and all attitudes toward the future in a single inexorable psychological parameter. If we take the most extreme version of the model, called the infinite horizon model, because agents calculate the consequences of their savings strategy for all their descendants until the end of time, as though they were thinking of themselves, in accordance with their own rate of time preference, it follows that the net rate of return on capital cannot vary by even as little as 0.1%. Any attempt to alter the net return, for example, by changing tax policy, will trigger an infinitely powerful reaction in one sense or another, saving or dissaving, in order to force the net return back to its unique equilibrium. Such a prediction is scarcely realistic. History shows that the elasticity of saving is positive, but not infinite, especially when the rate of return varies within moderate and reasonable limits. Another difficulty with this theoretical model, in its strictest interpretation, is that it implies that the rate of return on capital, R, must, in order to maintain the economy in equilibrium, rise very rapidly with the growth rate, G, so that the gap between R and G should be greater in a rapidly growing economy than in one that is not growing at all. Once again, this prediction is not very realistic, nor is it compatible with historical experience. The return on capital may rise in a rapidly growing economy, but probably not enough to increase the gap R minus G significantly, to judge by observed historical experience. Note, however, that the intuition here is again partially valid, and in any case interesting from a strictly logical point of view. In the standard economic model, based on the existence of a perfect market for capital, in which each owner of capital receives a return equal to the highest marginal productivity available in the economy, and everyone can borrow as much as he or she wants at that rate, the reason why the return on capital R is systematically and necessarily higher than the growth rate G is the following. If R were less than G, economic agents, realizing that their future income, and that of their descendants, will rise faster than the rate at which they can borrow, will feel infinitely wealthy, and will therefore wish to borrow without limit in order to consume immediately, until R rises above G. In this extreme form, the mechanism is not entirely plausible, but it shows that R is greater than G is true in the most standard of economic models, and is even more likely to be true as capital markets become more efficient. To recap, savings behavior and attitudes toward the future cannot be encapsulated in a single parameter, These choices need to be analyzed in more complex models, involving not only time preference, but also precautionary savings, life cycle effects, the importance attached to wealth in itself, and many other factors. These choices depend on the social and institutional environment, such as the existence of a public pension system, family strategies and pressures, and limitations that social groups impose on themselves. For example, in some aristocratic societies, heirs are not free to sell family property, in addition to individual psychological and cultural factors. To my way of thinking, the inequality R is greater than G should be analyzed as a historical reality dependent on a variety of mechanisms and not as an absolute logical necessity. It is the result of a confluence of forces, each largely independent of the others. For one thing, the rate of growth G tends to be structurally low, generally not much more than 1% a year once the demographic transition is complete and the country reaches the world technological frontier, where the pace of innovation is fairly slow. For another, the rate of return on capital, R, depends on many technological, psychological, social, and cultural factors, which together seem to result in a return of roughly 4 to 5%, in any event, distinctly greater than 1%. Is there an equilibrium distribution? Let me now turn to the consequences of R is greater than G for the dynamics of the wealth distribution. The fact that the return on capital is distinctly and persistently greater than the growth rate is a powerful force for a more unequal distribution of wealth. For example, if G equals 1% and R equals 5%, wealthy individuals have to reinvest only one-fifth of their annual capital income to ensure that their capital will grow faster than average income. Under these conditions, the only forces that can avoid an indefinite inegalitarian spiral and stabilize inequality of wealth at a finite level are the following. First, if the fortunes of wealthy individuals grow more rapidly than average income, the capital-income ratio will rise indefinitely, which in the long run should lead to a decrease in the rate of return on capital. Nevertheless, this mechanism can take decades to operate, especially in an open economy in which wealthy individuals can accumulate foreign assets, as was the case in Britain and France in the 19th century and up to the eve of World War I. In principle, this process always comes to an end when those who own foreign assets take possession of the entire planet. But this can obviously take time. This process was largely responsible for the vertiginous increase in the top centile's share of wealth in Britain and France during the Belle Époque. Furthermore, in regard to the trajectories of individual fortunes, this divergent process can be countered by shocks of various kinds, whether demographic, such as the absence of an heir or the presence of too many heirs, leading to dispersal of the family capital, or early death, or prolonged life, or economic, such as a bad investment, or a peasant uprising, or a financial crisis, or a mediocre season, etc. Shocks of this sort always affect family fortunes, so that changes in the wealth distribution occur even in the most static societies. Note, moreover, the importance of demographic choices. The fewer children the rich choose to have, the more concentrated wealth becomes, and inheritance laws. Many traditional aristocratic societies were based on the principle of primogeniture. The eldest son inherited all, or, at any rate, a disproportionately large share of the family property, so as to avoid fragmentation and to preserve or increase the family's wealth. The eldest son's privilege concerned the family's primary estate in particular, and often placed heavy constraints on the property. The heir was not allowed to diminish its value and was obliged to live on the income from the capital, which was then conveyed in turn to the next heir in the line of succession, usually the eldest grandson. In British law, this was the system of entails, the equivalent in French law being the system of substitution héréditaire under the Ancien Régime. It was the reason for the misfortune of Eleanor and Marianne in Sense and Sensibility. The Norland estate passed directly to their father and half-brother, John Dashwood, who decided, after considering the matter with his wife Fanny, to leave them nothing. The fate of the two sisters is a direct consequence of this sinister conversation. In Persuasion, Sir Walter's estate goes directly to his nephew, bypassing his three daughters. Jane Austen, herself disfavored by inheritance, and left a spinster, along with her sister, knew what she was talking about. The inheritance law that derived from the French Revolution and the civil code that followed rested on two main pillars: the abolition of substitution héréditaire and primogeniture, and the adoption of the principle of equal division of property among brothers and sisters, equipartition. This principle has been applied strictly and consistently since 1804. In France, the quotité disponible, that is, the share of the estate that parents are free to dispose of as they wish, is only a quarter of total wealth for parents with three or more children, and exemption is granted only in extreme circumstances. For example, if the children murder their stepmother. It is important to understand that the new law was based not only on the principle of equality. Younger children were valued as much as the eldest and protected from the whims of the parents, but also on a principle of liberty and economic efficiency, in particular, the abolition of entails, which Adam Smith disliked and Voltaire, Rousseau, and Montesquieu abhorred, rested on a simple idea. This abolition allowed the free circulation of goods and the possibility of reallocating property to the best possible use in the judgment of the living generation, despite what dead ancestors may have thought. Interestingly, after considerable debate, Americans came to the same conclusion in the years after the Revolution. Entails were forbidden, even in the South. As Thomas Jefferson famously put it, "The earth belongs to the living," and equipartition of estates among siblings became the legal default, that is, the rule that applied in the absence of an explicit will. Although the freedom to make one's will as one pleases still prevails in both the United States and Britain, in practice, most estates are equally divided among siblings. This was an important difference between France and the United States, on the one hand, where the law of equipartition applied from the 19th century on, and Britain, on the other, where primogeniture remained the default in 1925 for a portion of the parental property, namely, landed and agricultural capital. In Germany, it was not until the Weimar Republic that the German equivalent of entails was abolished in 1919. During the French Revolution, this egalitarian, anti-authoritarian liberal legislation, which challenged parental authority while affirming that of the new family head, in some case to the detriment of his spouse, was greeted with considerable optimism, at least by men, despite being quite radical for the time. Proponents of this revolutionary legislation were convinced that they had found the key to future equality. Since, moreover, the civil code granted everyone equal rights with respect to the market and property, and guilds had been abolished, the ultimate outcome seemed clear. Such a system would inevitably eliminate the inequalities of the past. The Marquis de Condorcet gave forceful expression to this optimistic view in his Esquisse d'un tableau historique des progrès de l'esprit humain, 1794. It is easy to prove that fortunes tend naturally toward equality, and that excessive differences of wealth either cannot exist or must promptly cease if the civil laws do not establish artificial ways of perpetuating and amassing such fortunes, and if freedom of commerce and industry eliminate the advantage that any prohibitive law or fiscal privilege gives to acquired wealth. The Civil Code and the illusion of the French Revolution. How, then, are we to explain the fact that the concentration of wealth increased steadily in France throughout the 19th century and ultimately peaked in the Belle Époque, at a level even more extreme than when the Civil Code was introduced, and scarcely less than in monarchical and aristocratic Britain? Clearly, Equality of rights and opportunities is not enough to ensure an egalitarian distribution of wealth. Indeed, once the rate of return on capital significantly and durably exceeds the growth rate, the dynamics of the accumulation and transmission of wealth automatically lead to a very highly concentrated distribution, and egalitarian sharing among siblings does not make much of a difference. As I mentioned a moment ago, there are always economic and demographic shocks that affect the trajectories of individual family fortunes. With the aid of a fairly simple mathematical model, one can show that for a given structure of shocks of this kind, the distribution of wealth tends toward a long-run equilibrium, and that the equilibrium level of inequality is an increasing function of the gap R minus G between the rate of return on capital and the growth rate. Intuitively, the difference R minus G measures the rate at which capital income diverges from average income if none of it is consumed and everything is reinvested in the capital stock. The greater the difference R minus G, the more powerful the divergent force. If the demographic and economic shocks take a multiplicative form, that is, the greater the initial capital, the greater the effect of a good or bad investment, the long-run equilibrium distribution is a Pareto distribution, a mathematical form based on a power law, which corresponds fairly well to distributions observed in practice. One can also show fairly easily that the coefficient of the Pareto distribution, which measures the degree of inequality, is a steeply increasing function of the difference, R minus G. Concretely, what this means is that if the gap between the return on capital and the growth rate is as high as that observed in France in the 19th century, when the average rate of return was 5% a year and growth was roughly 1%, the model predicts that the cumulative dynamics of wealth accumulation will automatically give rise to an extremely high concentration of wealth, with typically around 90% of capital owned by the top decile and more than 50% by the top centile. In other words, the fundamental inequality, R is greater than G, can explain the very high level of capital inequality observed in the 19th century, and thus, in a sense, the failure of the French Revolution. Although the revolutionary assemblies established a universal tax, and in so doing provided us with a peerless instrument for measuring the distribution of wealth, the tax rate was so low, barely 1 to 2% on directly transmitted estates, no matter how large, throughout the 19th century, that it had no measurable impact on the difference between the rate of return on capital and the growth rate. Under these conditions, it is no surprise that inequality of wealth was as great in 19th century France, and even during the Republican Belle Époque, as in monarchical Britain. The formal nature of the regime was of little moment compared with the inequality R is greater than G. Equipartition of estates between siblings did have some effect, but less than the gap R minus G. Concretely, primogeniture, or more precisely, primogeniture on agricultural land, which accounted for a decreasing share of British national capital over the course of the 19th century, magnified the effects of demographic and economic shocks, creating additional inequality depending on one's rank in the sibling order, and thus increased the Pareto coefficient and gave rise to a more concentrated distribution of wealth. This may help to explain why the top decile's share of total wealth was greater in Britain than in France in 1900 to 1910, slightly more than 90% compared with slightly less in France, and especially why the top centile's share was significantly greater on the British side of the Channel, 70% versus 60%. Since this appears to have been based on the preservation of a small number of very large landed estates. But this effect was partly compensated by France's low demographic growth rate. Cumulative inequality of wealth is structurally greater when the population is stagnant, again because of the difference between R and G. And in the end, it had only a moderate effect on the overall distribution, which was fairly close in the two countries. In Paris, where the Napoleonic Civil Code came into effect in 1804, and where inequality cannot be laid at the door of British aristocrats and the Queen of England, The top centile owned more than 70% of total wealth in 1913, even more than in Britain. The reality was so striking that it even found expression in an animated cartoon, The Aristocats, set in Paris in 1910. The size of the old lady's fortune is not mentioned, but to judge by the splendor of her residence and by the zeal of her butler Edgar to get rid of Duchess and her three kittens, it must have been considerable. In terms of the R is greater than G logic, the fact that the growth rate increased from barely 0.2% prior to 1800 to 0.5% in the 18th century and then to 1% in the 19th century does not seem to have made much of a difference. It was still small compared to a return on capital of around 5%, especially since the Industrial Revolution appears to have slightly increased that return. According to the theoretical model, if the return on capital is around 5% a year, the equilibrium concentration of capital will not decrease significantly unless the growth rate exceeds 1.5 to 2%, or taxes on capital reduce the net return to below 3 to 3.5%, or both. Note, finally, that if the difference, R minus G, surpasses a certain threshold, there is no equilibrium distribution. Inequality of wealth will increase without limit, and the gap between the peak of the distribution and the average will grow indefinitely. The exact level of this threshold, of course, depends on savings behavior. Divergence is more likely to occur if the very wealthy have nothing to spend their money on and no choice but to save and add to their capital stock. The Aristocats calls attention to the problem. Adelaide de Bonfamille obviously enjoys a handsome income, which she lavishes on piano lessons and painting classes for Duchess, Marie, Toulouse, and Berlioz, who are somewhat bored by it all. This kind of behavior explains quite well the rising concentration of wealth in France, and particularly in Paris, in the Belle Époque. The largest fortunes increasingly belonged to the elderly, who saved a large fraction of their capital income so that their capital grew significantly faster than the economy. As noted, such an inegalitarian spiral cannot continue indefinitely. Ultimately, there will be no place to invest the savings, and the global return on capital will fall until an equilibrium distribution emerges. But that can take a very long time, and since the top centile's share of Parisian wealth in 1913 already exceeded 70%, it is legitimate to ask how high the equilibrium level would have been had the shocks due to World War I not occurred. Pareto and the illusion of stable inequality. It is worth pausing a moment to discuss some methodological and historical issues concerning the statistical measurement of inequality. In Chapter 7, I discussed the Italian statistician Corrado Gini and his famous coefficient. Although the Gini coefficient was intended to sum up inequality in a single number, it actually gives a simplistic, overly optimistic, and difficult-to-interpret picture of what is really going on. A more interesting case is that of Gini's compatriot, Vilfredo Pareto, whose major works, including a discussion of the famous Pareto Law, were published between 1890 and 1910. In the interwar years, the Italian fascists adopted Pareto as one of their own and promoted his theory of elites. Although they were no doubt seeking to capitalize on his prestige, it is nevertheless true that Pareto, shortly before his death in 1923, hailed Mussolini's accession to power. Of course, the fascists would naturally have been attracted to Pareto's theory of stable inequality and the pointlessness of trying to change it. What is more striking when one reads Pareto's work with the benefit of hindsight is that he clearly had no evidence to support his theory of stability. Pareto was writing in 1900 or thereabouts. He used available tax tables from 1880 to 1890, based on data from Prussia and Saxony, as well as several Swiss and Italian cities. The information was scanty and covered a decade at most. What is more, it showed a slight trend toward higher inequality, which Pareto intentionally sought to hide. In any case, it is clear that such data provide no basis whatsoever for any conclusion about the long-term behavior of inequality around the world. Pareto's judgment was clearly influenced by his political prejudices. He was above all wary of socialists and what he took to be their redistributive illusions. In this respect, he was hardly different from any number of contemporary colleagues, such as the French economist Pierre Leroy Beaulieu, whom he admired. Pareto's case is interesting because it illustrates the powerful illusion of eternal stability, to which the uncritical use of mathematics in the social sciences sometimes leads. Seeking to find out how rapidly the number of taxpayers decreases as one climbs higher in the income hierarchy, Pareto discovered that the rate of decrease could be approximated by a mathematical law that subsequently became known as Pareto's law, or alternatively as an instance of a general class of functions known as power laws. Indeed, this family of functions is still used today to study distributions of wealth and income. Note, however, that the power law applies only to the upper tail of these distributions, and that the relation is only approximate and locally valid. It can nevertheless be used to model processes due to multiplicative shocks, like those described earlier. Note, moreover, that we are speaking not of a single function or curve, but of a family of functions. Everything depends on the coefficients and parameters that define each individual curve. The data collected in the WTID, as well as the data on wealth presented here, show that these Pareto coefficients have varied enormously over time. When we say that a distribution of wealth is a Pareto distribution, we have not really said anything at all. It may be a distribution in which the upper decile receives only slightly more than 20% of total income, as in Scandinavia in 1970 to 1980, or one in which the upper decile receives 50%, as in the United States in 2000 to 2010, or one in which the upper decile owns more than 90% of total wealth, as in France and Britain in 1900 to 1910. In each case, we are dealing with a Pareto distribution, but the coefficients are quite different. The corresponding social, economic, and political realities are clearly poles apart. Even today, some people imagine, as Pareto did, that the distribution of wealth is rock stable, as if it were somehow a law of nature. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. When we study inequality in historical perspective, the important thing to explain is not the stability of the distribution, but the significant changes that occur from time to time. In the case of the wealth distribution, I have identified a way to explain the very large historical variations that occur, whether described in terms of Pareto coefficients or as shares of the top decile and centile, in terms of the difference R minus G between the rate of return on capital and the growth rate of the economy. Why inequality of wealth has not returned to the levels of the past. I come now to the essential question. Why has the inequality of wealth not returned to the level achieved in the Belle Époque, and can we be sure that this situation is permanent and irreversible? Let me state at the outset that I have no definitive and totally satisfactory answer to this question. Several factors have played important roles in the past, and will continue to do so in the future, and it is quite simply impossible to achieve mathematical certainty on this point. The very substantial reduction in inequality of wealth following the shocks of 1914 to 1945 is the easiest part to explain. Capital suffered a series of extremely violent shocks as a result of the wars and the policies to which they gave rise, and the capital-income ratio therefore collapsed. One might, of course, think that the reduction of wealth would have affected all fortunes proportionately, regardless of their rank in the hierarchy, leaving the distribution of wealth unchanged. But to believe this, one would have to forget the fact that wealth has different origins and fulfills different functions. At the very top of the hierarchy, most wealth was accumulated long ago, and it takes much longer to reconstitute such a large fortune than to accumulate a modest one. Furthermore, the largest fortunes serve to finance a certain lifestyle, The detailed probate records collected from the archives show unambiguously that many rentiers in the interwar years did not reduce expenses sufficiently rapidly to compensate for the shocks to their fortunes and income during the war and in the decade that followed, so that they eventually had to eat into their capital to finance current expenditures. Hence, they bequeathed to the next generation fortunes significantly smaller than those they had inherited, and the previous social equilibrium could no longer be sustained. The Parisian data are particularly eloquent on this point. For example, the wealthiest 1% of Parisians in the Belle Époque had capital income roughly 80 to 100 times as great as the average wage of that time, which enabled them to live very well and still reinvest a small portion of their income and thus increase their inherited wealth. From 1872 to 1912, the system appears to have been perfectly balanced. The wealthiest individuals passed on to the next generation enough to finance a lifestyle requiring 80 to 100 times the average wage, or even a bit more, so that wealth became even more concentrated. This equilibrium clearly broke down in the interwar years. The wealthiest 1% of Parisians continued to live more or less as they had always done, but left the next generation just enough to yield capital income of 30 to 40 times the average wage. By the late 1930s, this had fallen to just 20 times the average wage. For the rentier, this was the beginning of the end. This was probably the most important reason for the deconcentration of wealth that we see in all European countries, and to a less extent in the United States, in the wake of the shocks of 1914 to 1945. In addition, the composition of the largest fortunes left them, on average, more exposed to losses due to the two world wars. In particular, the probate records show that foreign assets made up as much as a quarter of the largest fortunes on the eve of World War I, nearly half of which consisted of the sovereign debt of foreign governments, especially Russia, which was on the verge of default. Unfortunately, we do not have comparable data for Britain, but there is no doubt that foreign assets played at least as important a role in the largest British fortunes. In both France and Britain, foreign assets virtually disappeared after the two world wars. The importance of this factor should not be overstated, however, since the wealthiest individuals were often in a good position to reallocate their portfolios at the most profitable moment. It is also striking to discover that many individuals, and not just the wealthiest, owned significant amounts of foreign assets on the eve of World War I. When we examine the structure of Parisian portfolios in the late 19th century and Belle Époque, we find that they were highly diversified and quite modern in their composition. On the eve of the war, about a third of assets were in real estate, of which approximately two-thirds was in Paris and one-third in the provinces, including a small amount of agricultural land, while financial assets made up almost two-thirds. The latter consisted of both French and foreign stocks and, public as well as private, bonds, fairly well balanced at all levels of wealth. See PDF Table 10.1. The society of rentiers that flourished in the Belle Époque was not a society of the past based on static landed capital. It embodied a modern attitude toward wealth and investment. But the cumulative inegalitarian logic of R is greater than G made it prodigiously and persistently inegalitarian. In such a society, there is not much chance that freer, more competitive markets or more secure property rights can reduce inequality, since markets were already highly competitive and property rights firmly secured. In fact, the only thing that undermined this equilibrium was the series of shocks to capital and its income that began with World War I. Finally, the period 1914 to 1945 ended in a number of European countries, and especially in France, with a redistribution of wealth that affected the largest fortunes disproportionately, especially those consisting largely of stock in large industrial firms. Recall, in particular, the nationalization of certain companies as a sanction after liberation. The Renault Automobile Company is the emblematic example, as well as the National Solidarity Tax, which was also imposed in 1945. This progressive tax was a one-time levy on both capital and acquisitions made during the occupation, but the rates were extremely high and imposed an additional burden on the individuals affected. Some partial explanations. Time, taxes, and growth. In the end, then, it is hardly surprising that the concentration of wealth decreased sharply everywhere between 1910 and 1950. In other words, the descending portion of PDF figures 10.1 to 5 is not the most difficult part to explain. The more surprising part at first glance, and in a way the more interesting part, is that the concentration of wealth never recovered from the shocks I have been discussing. To be sure, it is important to recognize that capital accumulation is a long-term process extending over several generations. The concentration of wealth in Europe during the Belle Époque was the result of a cumulative process over many decades, or even centuries. It was not until 2000 to 2010 that total private wealth, in both real estate and financial assets, expressed in years of national income, regained roughly the level it had attained on the eve of World War I. This restoration of the capital-income ratio in the rich countries is in all probability a process that is still ongoing. It is not very realistic to think that the violent shocks of 1914 to 1945 could have been erased in 10 or 20 years, thereby restoring by 1950 to 1960 a concentration of wealth equal to that seen in 1900 to 1910. Note, too, that inequality of wealth began to rise again in 1970 to 1980. It is therefore possible that a catch-up process is still underway today, a process even slower than the revival of the capital-income ratio, and that the concentration of wealth will soon return to past heights. In other words, the reason why wealth today is not as unequally distributed as in the past is simply that not enough time has passed since 1945. This is no doubt part of the explanation, but by itself it is not enough. When we look at the top decile's share of wealth, and even more at the top centiles, which was 60 to 70% across Europe in 1910 and only 20 to 30% in 2010, it seems clear that the shocks of 1914 to 1945 caused a structural change that is preventing wealth from becoming quite as concentrated as it was previously. The point is not simply quantitative. Far from it. In the next chapter, we will see that when we look again at the question raised by Vautrin's lecture on the different standards of living that can be attained by inheritance and labor, the difference between a 60 to 70% share for the top centile and a 20 to 30% share is relatively simple. In the first case, the top centile of the income hierarchy is very clearly dominated by top capital incomes. This is the society of rentiers familiar to 19th century novelists. In the second case, top earned incomes, for a given distribution, roughly balance top capital incomes. We are now in a society of managers, or at any rate, a more balanced society. Similarly, the emergence of a patrimonial middle class, owning between a quarter and a third of national wealth, rather than a tenth or a twentieth, scarcely more than the poorest half of society, represents a major social transformation. What structural changes occurred between 1914 and 1945, and more generally during the 20th century, that are preventing the concentration of wealth from regaining its previous heights, even though private wealth overall is prospering almost as handsomely today as in the past? The most natural and important explanation is that governments in the 20th century began taxing capital and its income at significant rates. It is important to notice that the very high concentration of wealth observed in 1900 to 1910 was the result of a long period without a major war or catastrophe, at least when compared to the extreme violence of 20th century conflicts, as well as without, or almost without, taxes. Until World War I, there was no tax on capital income or corporate profits. In the rare cases in which such taxes did exist, they were assessed at very low rates. Hence, conditions were ideal for the accumulation and transmission of considerable fortunes and for living on the income of those fortunes. In the 20th century, taxes of various kinds were imposed on dividends, interest, profits, and rents, and this changed things radically. To simplify matters, assume initially that capital income was taxed at an average rate close to 0%, and in any case less than 5%, before 1900 to 1910, and at about 30% in the rich countries in 1950 to 1980, and to some extent until 2000 to 2010, although the recent trend has been clearly downward as governments engage in fiscal competition spearheaded by smaller countries. An average tax rate of 30% reduces a pre-tax return of 5% to a net return of 3.5% after taxes. This in itself is enough to have significant long-term effects, given the multiplicative and cumulative logic of capital accumulation and concentration. Using the theoretical models described above, one can show that an effective tax rate of 30%, if applied to all forms of capital, can by itself account for a very significant deconcentration of wealth, roughly equal to the decrease in the top centile's share that we see in the historical data. In this context, it is important to note that the effect of the tax on capital income is not to reduce the total accumulation of wealth, but to modify the structure of the wealth distribution over the long run. In terms of the theoretical model, as well as in the historical data, an increase in the tax on capital income from 0 to 30%, reducing the net return on capital from 5 to 3.5%, may well leave the total stock of capital unchanged over the long run for the simple reason that the decrease in the upper centile's share of wealth is compensated by the rise of the middle class. This is precisely what happened in the 20th century, although the lesson is sometimes forgotten today. It is also important to note the rise of progressive taxes in the 20th century, that is, of taxes that imposed higher rates on top incomes and especially top capital incomes, at least until 1970 to 1980, along with estate taxes on the largest estates. In the 19th century, estate tax rates were extremely low, no more than 1 to 2% on bequests from parents to children. A tax of this sort obviously has no discernible effect on the process of capital accumulation. It is not so much a tax as a registration fee intended to protect property rights. The estate tax became progressive in France in 1901, but the highest rate on direct line bequests was no more than 5%, and applied to at most a few dozen bequests a year. A rate of this magnitude, assessed once a generation, cannot have much effect on the concentration of wealth, no matter what wealthy individuals thought at the time. Quite different in their effect were the rates of 20 to 30% or higher that were imposed in most wealthy countries in the wake of the military, economic, and political shocks of 1914 to 1945. The upshot of such taxes was that each successive generation had to reduce its expenditures and save more, or else make particularly profitable investments if the family fortune was to grow as rapidly as average income. Hence, it became more and more difficult to maintain one's rank. Conversely, it became easier for those who started at the bottom to make their way, for instance, by buying businesses or shares sold when estates went to probate. Simple simulations show that a progressive estate tax can greatly reduce the top centile's share of wealth over the long run. The differences between estate tax regimes in different countries can also help to explain international differences. For example, why have top capital incomes in Germany been more concentrated than in France since World War II, suggesting a higher concentration of wealth? Perhaps because the highest estate tax rate in Germany is no more than 15 to 20%, compared with 30 to 40% in France. Both theoretical arguments and numerical simulations suggest that taxes suffice to explain most of the observed evolutions, even without invoking structural transformations. It is worth reiterating that the concentration of wealth today, though markedly lower than in 1900 to 1910, remains extremely high. It does not require a perfect, ideal tax system to achieve such a result or to explain a transformation whose magnitude should not be exaggerated. The 21st century, even more inegalitarian than the 19th? Given the many mechanisms in play and the multiple uncertainties involved in tax simulations, it would nevertheless be going too far to conclude that no other factors played a significant role. My analysis thus far has shown that two factors probably did play an important role, independent of changes in the tax system, and will continue to do so in the future. The first is the probable slight decrease in capital's share of income and in the rate of return on capital over the long run. And the second is that the rate of growth, despite a likely slowing in the 21st century, will be greater than the extremely low rate observed throughout most of human history up to the 18th century. Here I am speaking of the purely economic component of growth, that is, growth of productivity, which reflects the growth of knowledge and technological innovation. Concretely, as PDF Figure 10.11 shows, it is likely that the difference, R is greater than G, will be smaller in the future than it was before the 18th century, both because the return on capital will be lower, 4 to 4.5%, say, rather than 4.5 to 5%, and growth will be higher, 1 to 1.5%, rather than 0.1 to 0.2%. Even if competition between states leads to the elimination of all taxes on capital. If theoretical simulations are to be believed, the concentration of wealth, even if taxes on capital are abolished, would not necessarily return to the extreme level of 1900 to 1910. There are no grounds for rejoicing, however, in part because inequality of wealth would still increase substantially. Halving the middle class share of national wealth, for example, which voters might well find unacceptable, and in part because there is considerable uncertainty in the simulations, and other forces exist that may well push in the opposite direction, that is, toward an even greater concentration of capital than in 1900 to 1910. In particular, demographic growth may be negative, which could drive growth rates, especially in the wealthy countries, below those observed in the 19th century. And this would in turn give unprecedented importance to inherited wealth. In addition, capital markets may become more and more sophisticated and more perfect in the sense used by economists, meaning that the return on capital will become increasingly disconnected from the individual characteristics of the owner, and therefore cut against meritocratic values, reinforcing the logic of R is greater than G. As I will show later, in addition, financial globalization seems to be increasing the correlation between the return on capital and the initial size of the investment portfolio, creating an inequality of returns that acts as an additional, and quite worrisome, force for divergence in the global wealth distribution. To sum up, the fact that wealth is noticeably less concentrated in Europe today than it was in the Belle Époque is largely a consequence of accidental events, the shocks of 1914 to 1945, and specific institutions, such as taxation of capital and its income. If those institutions were ultimately destroyed, there would be a high risk of seeing inequalities of wealth close to those observed in the past, or, under certain conditions, even higher. Nothing is certain. Inequality can move in either direction. Hence, I must now look more closely at the dynamics of inheritance, and then at the global dynamics of wealth. One conclusion is already quite clear, however. It is an illusion to think that something about the nature of modern growth, or the laws of the market economy, ensures that inequality of wealth will decrease, and harmonious stability will be achieved. Chapter 11. Merit and Inheritance in the Long Run. The overall importance of capital today, as noted, is not very different from what it was in the 18th century. Only its form has changed. Capital was once mainly land, but is now industrial, financial, and real estate. We also know that the concentration of wealth remains high, although it is noticeably less extreme than it was a century ago. The poorest half of the population still owns nothing, but there is now a patrimonial middle class that owns between a quarter and a third of total wealth, and the wealthiest 10% now own only two-thirds of what there is to own, rather than nine-tenths. We have also learned that the relative movements of the return on capital and the rate of growth of the economy, and therefore of the difference between them, R minus G, can explain many of the observed changes, including the logic of accumulation that accounts for the very high concentration of wealth that we see throughout much of human history. In order to understand this cumulative logic better, we must now take a closer look at the long-term evolution of the relative roles of inheritance and saving in capital formation. This is a crucial issue, because a given level of capital concentration can come about in totally different ways. It may be that the global level of capital has remained the same, but that its deep structure has changed dramatically, in the sense that capital was once largely inherited, but is now accumulated over the course of a lifetime by savings from earned income. One possible explanation for such a change might be increased life expectancy, which might have led to a structural increase in the accumulation of capital in anticipation of retirement. However, this supposed great transformation in the nature of capital was actually less dramatic than is sometimes thought. Indeed, in some countries, it did not occur at all. In all likelihood, inheritance will again play a significant role in the 21st century, comparable to its role in the past. More precisely, I will come to the following conclusion. Whenever the rate of return on capital is significantly and durably higher than the growth rate of the economy, it is all but inevitable that inheritance, of fortunes accumulated in the past, predominates over saving, wealth accumulated in the present. In strict logic, it could be otherwise, but the forces pushing in this direction are extremely powerful. The inequality R is greater than G, in one sense, implies that the past tends to devour the future. Wealth originating in the past automatically grows more rapidly, even without labor, than wealth stemming from work, which can be saved. Almost inevitably, this tends to give lasting, disproportionate importance to inequalities created in the past, and therefore to inheritance. If the 21st century turns out to be a time of low demographic and economic growth and high return on capital, in a context of heightened international competition for capital resources, or at any rate in countries where these conditions hold true, inheritance will therefore probably again be as important as it was in the 19th century. An evolution in this direction is already apparent in France, and a number